Do you remember when thuggish National Guard director Viktor Zolotov challenged Alexei Navalny to a duel, threatening to pound him into hamburger or mincemeat or whatever? Well, is that the same approach that Russia has towards negotiations with Ukraine? Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. To an extent, I'm being disingenuous. The obvious answer to the question I pose in the opener is yes, that is exactly how the Russians seem to be trying to reach some kind of basis for negotiation with Ukraine by pounding it into mincemeat. However, beyond a slightly contrived way of trying to connect the two halves of this podcast, the first of which will be about negotiation and the second bit will be about Zolotov, what I wanted to do was use this as a chance to raise and discuss some of the issues around a very interesting and I think important recent article that appeared in Foreign Affairs, The Talks That Could Have Ended the War in Ukraine, by Sam Charop and Sergei Radchenko. Now, it has aroused a considerable degree of controversy, I think that's fair to say, and I don't really want to get into some of the weeds of the discussions that have been had, which is very much challenging some of the assumptions and the interpretations that they make. In short, Charop and Radchenko had the opportunity to look at a whole bunch of different drafts of the negotiations which were being carried out at the very beginning of the war, as well as the opportunity to talk to some of the people involved and obviously look at interviews and the like. And from that, they concluded that actually there was some kind of apparent real impetus for negotiations, particularly after the immediate stab at Kyiv had patently failed, which rolled on for a while until, yes, after the Bucha, particularly massacre, but also particularly once it became clear to the Ukrainians that they might have a chance at actually winning this war, and also as some of the internal challenges of the whole notion of negotiations really began to become clear. And look, a lot of people have frankly attacked it on really the sort of quite unpleasant grounds that nonetheless have never, you know, have become essentially the norm for the debate these days, of anything that suggests that the Russians might, and I think I want to underscore that, as indeed do the authors, been willing to actually negotiate in good faith, is regarded as somehow a Putin-friendly narrative, recounting Russian talking points, questions being asked about the bona fides of the individuals concerned, particularly Sam Charop at RAND, who is being sort of presented as some kind of, at best, ignorant dupe of the Kremlin, at worst, paid asset and so forth. I mean, quite frankly foolish, I think, in my opinion. We actually have to accept that, gosh, people do have different opinions. And that does not necessarily mean that they are under some kind of suborned control from outsiders. But I said, I don't really want to get into the weeds about the specifics of the article. There's, God knows, vast amounts about that already. Instead, I really want to pick up on some of the kind of broader meta issues that really it highlights. And obviously, I will give the usual link in the program notes to the article. And I'd strongly advise people to read it. You don't have to agree with everything there. In some ways, I don't think the authors do, in that they're just trying to present what's happening. But nonetheless, I think it's important. And the first point I want to raise is about sequencing. Now, at one point in the article, they talk about the idea that a treaty had been almost finished. However, as they themselves recognise, almost finished is actually often a very, very long way from finished. Because, as is so often the case, some of the thorniest issues had actually been punted either to the end or essentially for separate discussion. One of these was territory. Now, As initially formulated, essentially the Russians were promising to, at the very least, return to the pre-invasion February 22 invasion lines, possibly even further than that, but that Crimea would be subject to a 15-year period of negotiations over its future. So, again, they were willing to kind of punt that one to the future. But, of course, the whole question about other territorial issues. Would the Russians really have been willing to basically hand back those bits of Donetsk and Luhansk that they had been controlling since 2014-2015? That seems hard to believe. And conversely, could Zelensky have actually accepted anything that even temporarily continued to give Russia control over any region? So, actually the fact that the territorial issue had not been fully addressed was crucial. Even more important than that, and it's something that I'll actually be coming onto in a moment, is the question of allied guarantees. Entirely understandably, the Ukrainians were not just simply willing to accept a piece of paper as a guarantee for their future security, especially when the Russians also wanted not just neutrality, but a severely constrained Ukrainian army. And they can think back to the 1994 Budapest memo, which was where the Russians were part of the array of countries notionally guaranteeing Ukraine security. I mean, just stop on that Budapest memo. This was in the context of the Ukrainians giving up the nuclear weapons, the Soviet legacy nuclear weapons that were on their soil. Now, some people have said, that was clearly the big mistake. They should have held on to that. However, we need to note something. First of all, the Ukrainians could not use those nuclear weapons. The Russians had actually withdrawn certainly a lot of the tactical stuff before the end of the Soviet Union. And what was still there? Well, the Russians still had the codes for launching them. It's almost impossible to imagine that the Ukrainians would actually be able to use these nuclear weapons, even if just physically they were there on Ukrainian soil. And secondly, look, nuclear weapons don't just simply sit there until they're needed. They require a considerable amount of regular maintenance and upgrading and so forth. And again, Ukraine was just simply not in a position to afford to do this. It would have been a massive security risk for the world as a whole, and also an expensive white elephant for Ukraine. So, let's not sort of accept this line that some people say is, the West unfairly forced Ukraine to give up nukes that could have guaranteed its security in 1994, and therefore there is a moral claim or whatever. No. But nonetheless, it's also worth noting that the Budapest memo was not anything that guaranteed support for Ukraine if it was invaded. Rather, the signatories just simply agreed not to attack Ukraine and to convene a UN Security Council meeting if it was. Of course, Russia broke those terms, so there's no way of getting around that. But the point is, in that context, it is clear that Ukraine needed something very different from that. And what they were expecting and hoping is precisely allied guarantees tantamount to a NATO Article 5 guarantee. In other words, that they would actually go to war for Ukraine if need be. The teeny tiny problem is that the West had not been part of the negotiations up to this point. So to a degree, Ukraine was playing fantasy treaty. It was coming up with what it wanted the Allies to provide. And this, I think, helps explain this whole vexed question of the role of Boris Johnson. There is this whole narrative that Ukraine had been ready to sign a deal, and then Bojo rolls into town and basically tells the Ukrainians that they can't and that they have to continue fighting, and that somehow that therefore torpedoes the deal. Now, it does carry with it this slightly bizarre image of Boris Johnson as this world-bestriding colossus who can just simply lay down the law when he arrives in town, which does not quite correspond, I think it's fair to say, with the realities that we've experienced. Rather, what is clear, I think, is that Boris Johnson did have an influence in some ways as the herald and avatar of the West. He was the one who was basically saying, look, this is not going to happen. We are not going to provide that kind of guarantee that you're looking for. But we are willing to support you in your own fight against the invader. So, I think in this context, as I said, Boris was not so much the force that did it, so much as the the mouth that spoke the words of the wider West. But the point is, again, what we have is yet another issue, absolutely crucial, that had not actually been resolved. So this is why, I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that, yes, considerable work was done in terms of building up a potential treaty that might have ended the war. But I think it's very hard to see how they could have leapt over those final hurdles to actually turn almost into reality. And in particular, what really emerges from the article, and I think what is actually quite compelling, is that one of the reasons why the Ukrainians decided to back away from this process was precisely because, as things changed on the battlefield, they felt that what initially they had thought was this sort of storm that was crashing around them that could actually sweep away all of Ukraine was something that they could actually resist with the right assistance and support. And that this was one of, and I'd stress that, one of the factors why they actually decided to instead abandon that process. And it's interesting that since then, in many ways, Zelensky has taken moves to actually block off the possibility of further negotiations, saying that, for example, he would not negotiate with Putin, and putting a lot more weight on the fact that to actually surrender any territory, you would need a revision of the Ukrainian constitution, which obviously requires a big process and referenda and so forth. I think this is a crucial issue, though. It is the fact that it's very, very hard to see either side being willing to negotiate when it thinks time is on its side, when it thinks that actually 6 months, 12 months time, its position will be even stronger. And the irony is, at the moment, this is exactly what we see. The Ukrainians, look, they have been in a tough spot, but now the American deal, the American aid package has been approved. Well, it's going to be approved. Now, all it has to do is go through Senate, which it will happen, and then get President Biden's signature. So, essentially, having had some very rough months, one has to acknowledge, nonetheless, the aid is coming. And more to the point, 2025 offers, in their view, the chance for another proper counterattack with the full power and capabilities of additional weapon systems and the like factored in. So from their point of view, this is in some ways their low point. Things can only get better. Likewise, though, ironically, from the Russians' point of view. Now, again, it'll be interesting to see how far it's only just happened. So the US aid deal, whether that will actually change thinking in Moscow, I suspect not. But, that is a possibility. But the point is, from the Russians' point of view, they have made some advances. Again, nothing dramatic, incremental, but nonetheless, from their point of view, significant. And there are more advances, I think, that they're envisaging. Chasiv Yar and such like. So in that situation, again, why would you deal now if you think you're going to be in a stronger position, say, by the end of the year? So in that point of view, look, if you can move the front line that much in the right direction from your point of view, that then becomes the new baseline from which you negotiate. So again, this is the problem. It's actually at what point are both countries going to be in a position in which they're willing to see negotiation? Now, there is the maximalist notion. If the Russians suddenly crash through the Ukrainian lines and push all the way to the Dnipro, or conversely, if the Ukrainians are able to make sort of another sort of smashing advance, such as they did originally out of Kharkiv. And maybe this leads to a sort of progressive collapse of the Russian lines and panic and whatever else. Sure, in those kind of dramatic situations, even the victor might feel this is a good time to basically take fullest advantage of that position. But the point is, we're unlikely, certainly for the near future, to get anything of the sort. So I think this is the problem. This is why it comes down to the fact that at present, of course, it would be great if there were some meaningful negotiations that might would bring some kind of earlier end to the war. But ultimately, one can't get away from the suspicion that both sides are still going to have a lot of bleeding to do until they're ready to conceive of the possibility of negotiations because they honestly don't think that things are going to get any better for them. And that leads me to the next point that I think really emerged from the article, which is very much this issue about guarantees. Look, especially if Ukraine was going to accept any kind of limitations on its military and its sort of future political status as a neutral power, which I think probably by now are increasingly historical artifacts. I don't think they're going to happen. But nonetheless, it does raise the question of, you know, can there be any kind of a deal without serious security guarantees for Ukraine? And can those be anything other than NATO membership? Because that's often, I think, a very artificial dichotomy that says, do you support arming Ukraine and thus war? Or do you support negotiations and thus peace? And look, obviously, this is the kind of narrative that we often get from people who are in the latter camp, who want to present themselves as being morally superior, but also who deplore the ongoing tally of terrible deaths. And that's fair enough. But my view is that it's not arms or peace. It's that actually only through arms and support can there be peace, for the very issues I've raised before. If Russia honestly thinks that tomorrow is going to be better than today for any discussions, then they will pump them off until tomorrow. So in this context, both for Russia to feel it has to talk to Ukraine in a meaningful and productive way, but also for Ukraine to feel that it can talk to Russia, there will need to be those kind of guarantees. Because otherwise, all that happens, given that Putin's Russia has demonstrated that it is willing to break its deals, viz. Budapest memo, amongst other things, in those contexts, either Ukraine has to arm itself to an extraordinary degree and become some sort of large European Israel, which still does not mean that you will not face the continuing risk, or it needs those guarantees. And look, it is clear at the moment that NATO countries, not NATO as an institution, but NATO countries, on balance, do not want Ukraine in their alliance. Remember, it's going to have to be a unanimous decision of the members. And although that unanimity will probably involve a certain amount of arm twisting, particularly of smaller countries that might have reservations, but if the big boys and girls are supporting, they'll probably not get in the way. And yes, Hungary, we are looking at you amongst others. But moving beyond that, can one conceive of a genuine non-NATO guarantee that says we will put troops on the ground, we will accept a stream of body bags coming home in the name of defending Ukraine? And more to the point, will those guarantees be credible to the Russians and to the Ukrainians? At present, after all, yes, people don't want Ukrainian NATO to a large degree because exactly of the vulnerability. And it's also worth noting that I don't see how Ukraine can be in NATO without some kind of settlement of the border. Because you have to have, to put it bluntly, a border to defend. If you're actually going to say, yes, Ukraine is in NATO, but you're also going to say Crimea, Donbass, whatever, are actually parts of Ukraine, then you start with Russia already being an invader. And more or less, therefore, by definition, you would presumably say that actually NATO is at war with Russia from the point when, you know, even before the ink has dried on the accession document. No one's going to accept that, let's be honest. So instead, there has to be some line that says anything beyond this counts as an invasion, counts as a war. So NATO means fixing the borders, but also NATO means consensus. The thing is, can the United States commit itself without, for example, European countries committing itself? The answer is not really. A, because it plays absolutely into the kind of rhetoric that we're hearing from the Republicans at the moment about the degree to which Europe itself needs to be raising its game, rightly so. Not often that I find myself agreeing with the Republican rump. Nonetheless, on this point, yes, Europe does need to raise its game. It would also be actually logistically very difficult, as well as politically difficult, for the United States to step in if the rest of Europe was just simply saying, yeah, you go, guys, but we'll carry on sitting here. eating our cheese and swilling our beer and doing all the other things that the caricature Europeans do. So Europeans would have to be involved for practical, logistical, as well as political reasons. But the key thing is this, it is credibility. So let's say Britain, Germany, France and America, just to pick some obvious countries, all say, yes, we will bilaterally agree with Ukraine that we will step up in the case of war. That only works if Russia believes it. If Russia thinks this is a formidable enough threat. If one presumes that Russia is actually thinking of Ukraine invading Ukraine again, then one has to think about that they will be making these kind of calculations. The point about NATO, why NATO has been so phenomenally effective, is precisely that it is an engine of deterrence. That people, and essentially that means Russians, do believe in Article 5. They do believe that ultimately an attack on one member is an attack on all, and that they can expect a convincing rebuff. And of course, it is backed up by practical measures, particularly the placement, the forward basing of troops from other countries in the obvious potential flashpoint, which is the Baltic states. So that if the Russians rolled into Estonia and then the other Baltic states, they would not just be fighting and thus killing Baltic soldiers. They would also be killing Americans and Brits and Germans and so forth, which obviously has a higher political risk. So all of this nests together to mean that actually Russia, and I think it's fairly clear that this is definitely Putin's point of view, Russia is not willing to challenge NATO. Would it be willing to challenge some kind of bespoke bilateral security deals? Perhaps if, let's say, God forbid, the Chinese go after Taiwan, America finds itself embroiled in a war in the Pacific, other NATO countries to a degree are sucked in. I could imagine Britain, as usual, feeling its need to basically spend blood and treasure on America's wars. Nothing bitter there. And you know, actually at that point, Russia thinking, ha, maybe this is a strategic opportunity for us because the specific countries are detached from the issues in Europe at the moment. Which is why I honestly can't see how this war ends without Ukraine in NATO. I imagine it's the kind of process where they will go into negotiations with a determination that there will be no NATO membership, but that as the realities in the process become more and more clear, essentially NATO countries are faced with a stark choice. Either you let Ukraine in, or you basically accept that these talks are going to fail, and you're going to have to be continuing to spend billions every month in supporting Ukraine on an open-ended basis. So, I mean, I think actually this whole issue of arms or peace, and also the whole issue about where the role for the Allies in Ukraine's negotiations, I think so far have missed the point. You know, there is this talk about nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. The idea is, therefore, that America, NATO, EU, whoever, cannot negotiate over Ukraine's head. And that's absolutely right. However, there is a corollary, which is actually that next time, if and when, that there is, hopefully sooner than later, there are some kind of negotiations between Ukraine and Russia, then the Allies have to be in that process. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have an equal voice with the Ukrainians or anything like that, of course not. But the point is the Ukrainians cannot just draw up guarantees without consulting the Allies about what those guarantees actually would be and whether they're willing to support them. So in some ways, I think it's this is not a critique of the Ukrainians in 2022 so much as a pointer for the future of any kind of negotiations. And a final point. One of the issues on which a lot of people ended up criticising the argument, the article, was essentially because of saying, oh, it's just so naive, you're forgetting that one can never trust the Russians clearly actually were not taking this seriously, it was all just a smokescreen for their aggression, which may well be the case, though to be honest, it's not like the Russians seem so far to have been that concerned about how they look in the course of this ghastly war. And I think it also often pivots around a misunderstanding of the significance of the fact that the Russian delegation to the talks was headed, chaired by Vladimir Medinsky, who was the culture minister from 2012 to 2020, and then became an assistant to the president. And that sense that he is essentially just some kind of lightweight. Look, Medinsky is absolutely on the sort of cultural nationalist side of the political spectrum. He was, in my opinion, a pretty disastrous culture minister. However, we have to realise two things. First of all, he is trusted by Putin. His current position as assistant to the president. Now, that makes it sound like, you know, he basically pours him his tea. It's actually a much more significant role. It is in some ways, I suppose, a kind of a political analogue to the territorial plenipotential representatives to the various federal districts. In some ways, what it means is Medinsky is whatever Putin wants him to be right now and has the ability to basically pick up whatever political roles may well be needed. And the point is, I don't think Putin would have wanted someone who was willful with a power base of their own handling these talks. You know, he wanted essentially keep coming back to Tolkienian sort of parallels. Think of the mouth of Sauron. A awful, ghastly, formidable force, but nonetheless entirely just the channel for Sauron's voice. Well, that's essentially Vladimir Medinsky in this case, you know, without the black armour and the glowing red eyes and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, from that point of view, the fact that Medinsky was in charge does not actually say that the Russians weren't serious. In some ways, I would suggest quite the opposite. It means that there was a loyal sort of conduit there. But the most important thing is this. We don't need to trust the Russians. Any kind of credible negotiations, any kind of credible deal that is struck, has to have guarantees built in. Putin's Russia has demonstrated that it cannot be trusted, but that doesn't mean you don't talk to them. Frankly, half the time, the people you need most to negotiate with are precisely your antagonists, the people you're opposed to them. So I think the key thing is not to question Russian motivation and so forth, not to say, well, the Russians can't be trusted and therefore we can't talk to them. That's entirely pointless. It is rather, again, to go back to this point, that any kind of outcome has to have very, very concrete triggers for some kind of suitable penalty, which is enough to convince the Russians not to pull those triggers. So whether it's in terms of specific sanctions, whether it's in terms of foreign troops coming in to actually help the Ukrainians out, whatever it is that needs to be there. And then we go back to, sorry, this is a hobby horse of mine, the whole issue of strategic ambiguity. There can be no ambiguity in this case. There can be no, the co-signatories will agree to consider military assistance to Ukraine or anything like that. It has to be absolutely solid. We cannot trust the Russians, or the current Russian state rather, to be nice people. We cannot trust them to be trustworthy. However, we can trust them to be self-interested and pragmatic. And I think this is really, for me, one of the interesting lessons of this article, is that, in fact, the Russians, I think, from this point of view, were willing to see what could emerge from this process. You know, Putin is not, or certainly was not then, and I don't think is now, looking for absolute territorial control of all of Ukraine. He does not feel that it needs to be the Russian government that decides on public transport policy in Lviv or which roads get prioritised for resurfacing in Chernihiv region. No, what he wanted was that kind of overall sphere of influence dominance. He wanted to go back to the days when there was the opportunity to basically hire Ukrainian leaders, and we know which ones we're talking about, and it's not just one. But also the point when actually Ukraine was weak enough and biddable enough and interconnected with Russia enough that in effect it had to recognise that Russia was the dominant country. Now, I don't think it was ever quite as cut and dried as Putin believes, but again, that doesn't matter. We're talking about Putin's own views. But he wants hegemony. He wants essentially for Ukraine to be a dependency of Russia. And if he can get that by other means, he's perfectly happy to do so without some kind of exceedingly bloody war. He can maintain the antagonism with the West that helps sustain his rule in all sorts of other ways, without actually having to throw huge numbers of Russian lives and Russian money into the front line. So look, I mean, I think that it is clear that the Russians were seriously talking. It does not mean to say that this negotiation process could have actually got anywhere because of those pretty, if not insurmountable, but pretty formidable obstacles that I've already mentioned. But the point is, it shows that these things are possible. Now is, alas, I don't think the time for any kind of resumption. But it gives us some useful lessons as to what to be thinking about and how to approach it when the next time that particular window of opportunity opens. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Before I start on part two, just a quick public service announcement to patrons that this coming week you'll be getting a message about another round of, you know, basically questions being solicited for the next sort of patrons Q&A episode. So keep an eye out for that and think if there's anything that you'd like me to tackle. Anyway, what I want to talk about in the second half is one of my favourite, not favourite people, which is Viktor Vasilievich Zolotov, the director of the ridiculous title, really, Federal Service of the National Guard Troops of the Russian Federation. But we're going to call them the National Guard or the Rosgvardia. Because I think it's interesting that his position is actually in some kind of interesting question. Not that I think he is necessarily going to be toppled soon, but on the other hand, that he's becoming in some ways a political liability as well as a great political strength for Putin. So again, I think it says some interesting things about how the political system is shifting, and particularly how it has done since the Wagner mutiny in 2022. I really do think that, you know, the more time passes, you know, there was a chance that the mutiny would just become one of those sort of brief episodes that sound and look dramatic at the time, but then quickly just recede. I think actually we are going to find that the resonances and the political ripples from it prove to be perhaps rather more significant and rather more disruptive than perhaps thought at the time. Anyway, to return to Zolotov. He was born to a blue-collar family back in 1954, did his national service in the KGB border troops, which again, it's quite interesting there because this is a, you know, relatively low prestige position, but one absolutely reserved for people who seem politically reliable, which often means regarded as not smart enough to be unreliable, because after all, these people are going to be literally on the borders. Anyway, after that, he had a brief stint at the Zil Automobile Works in Moscow, and then he enrolled in the KGB, where he became a bodyguard in what's called the Ninth Directorate, which is the agency that was responsible for protecting VIPs and the like. He obviously became a member of the Communist Party, but there's absolutely no evidence that there was any kind of political commitment there. It was just simply you needed to be a communist to be in the KGB. In 1991, he became one of Yeltsin's close protection officers. And that's really quite interesting because, you know, at the time, the KGB was actually quite divided between people who thought that there was a need for change and people who were actually hardline conservative types. And on the whole, obviously, the latter were dominant. And therefore, actually being made part of Yeltsin's team was, in that respect, a kind of slightly sort of poison chalice, it seemed. It meant that to do so, he had to leave the KGB. But the point is, by this, you know, by then, power was already shifting to Yeltsin. And in particular, Zolotov was recruited by the man who became, well, who's Yeltsin's former bodyguard and became sort of head of his new security service, which is Alexander Korshakov, a deeply suspect character, more anon. And apparently he had very little trouble in actually persuading Zolotov to swap allegiances. And this was before the August coup. Remember, there's famous photography of Zolotov standing right behind Yeltsin when he's up there on an armoured vehicle, shouting his defiance against the coup plotters. So, in some ways, was this a gamble? Or was this actually the fact that Zolotov realised that his chances within the KGB were not that great? It is clear that often Zolotov does not, shall I say, win the favour of his immediate superiors. This is why, in some ways, his relationship with Putin is so unusual. Because, yes, of course, Yeltsin wins, the Soviet Union, you know, well, the hardliners are defeated, and then at the end of 1991, Gorbachev dissolves the Soviet Union. But the interesting thing is that although Zolotov had made the jump at the right time, it turns out, in fact, that he and Korshakov did not really get on. And so when Korshakov turned Yeltsin's security service into the new sort of presidential security service, as an elite component within the new Federal Protection Service, the FSO, Zolotov didn't make the cut. So he did not transfer to the new presidential team. He stayed within the FSO, but nonetheless, again, he was relegated to what seemed at the time to be definitely something of a secondary job, which was to be on the six-man protection team for one Anatoly Sobchak, the mayor of St. Petersburg. Fortuitously, that happened to be the same team on which one, in due course, Deputy Mayor Vladimir Putin was. And the interesting thing is, again, Zolotov had fallen on his feet. He became Putin's kind of like, one of his driver bodyguard team, essentially. But perhaps even more importantly, he became one of Putin's judo sparring partners. And that is absolutely sort of crucial. So in 1996, when Sobchak lost his position, Zolotov was dismissed from the FSO. And he briefly worked in this private security firm, Baltic Escort, which, let's just simply say that at the time, it was certainly dogged by allegations of organised crime links. That is a statement of fact. And far be it from me to suggest whether or not those allegations were true or not. But he didn't have to do that for long anyway. Because then Putin becomes prime minister in 1999, and he brings Zolotov back into the FSO. And in 2000, he jumps him up to being not just within the presidential security service, but actually heading it, which actually makes him also ex officio a deputy director of the FSO. So that's a very rapid jump. But again, it's quite sort of understandable or usual, frankly, for people who Putin personally feels comfortable with. So there he is in 2000. He has gone from being an sacked member of the sort of, you know, an individual's personal protection team all the way through to deputy head of one of the large, powerful security agencies in Russia, and indeed head of the president's own security team. And that continues. That continues until 2014. When Putin makes him first Deputy Interior Minister and Commander of the Interior Troops. Now, again, 2014, this is significant. It's as part of this general shift of Putin's to the political war era. Remember, 2011 and 2012, we had seen the Bolotnaya protests, large protests in Moscow, which, as far as Putin's concerned, was nothing actually to do with the growing middle class becoming particularly disenchanted and especially feeling they're being taken for granted with Putin returning to the presidency and rigged Duma elections. No, of course, these Bolotnaya protests were instigated by CIA and MI6 and the State Department and Hillary Clinton and you name it. And it showed that the West was coming to get him, and therefore he had to not just push back, but also bolster his own position. And at this time, the interior troops, who became the basis for the National Guard shortly thereafter, you know, are the main public security force on the streets, although certainly the most powerful of them. And so there was this sense that in some ways, protecting the president has now become a much more expansive thing. So it's not just simply about the FSO and the Presidential Security Service. It's about actually having a whole wider array of security agencies, all of which are there to protect Putin and protect his regime. And that's why he wanted Zolotov as a man who he thinks is absolutely loyal and absolutely willing to do whatever it needs to be in charge of them. So there he is. 2014, Deputy Interior Minister, Commander of the Interior Troops. He then goes next year, 2015, he becomes an Army General, a four-star general. And then crucially, in 2016, he becomes the founding director of the new National Guard, which sees the Interior Troops pulled out of the MVD, the Interior Ministry, supported by the Amon Riot Police, the Sober Police SWAT teams, and a few other bits and pieces. Precisely because at this time the Interior Ministry was becoming uncomfortable at the idea of being deployed as the Kremlin stormtroopers. You know, the Interior Minister Kolokoltsev had put years of effort into trying to actually improve relations with society, and when he said that in fact it may not be a good thing, well, certainly because this is what his local commanders were telling him, a good thing for the police to once again be interpreted by society as just simply the people who do the Kremlin's business and crack your skulls if you protest. Well, instead of, as Kolokoltsev had hoped, Putin moderating his notions as to how he would control society, he just simply said, well, clearly the Interior Ministry is not reliable. We need to actually take them out of the equation. So, National Guard is formed. 2016, Zolotov is in charge of his own agency, reporting solely and directly to the president. It's a good time for him. And of course, look, like all Russian officials, he does not live off his salary alone. And he and his family's portfolio of luxury properties, interest in everything from agriculture to construction, you know, continue to expand. I think their total net worth is estimated in the tens of millions of dollars. And interestingly, Dima Tsilevich, who's the woman who has reported to be Zolotov's, shall we say, additional romantic partner, and is now the power, incidentally, coincidentally, behind Baltic Escort, is herself worth tens of millions herself. And it's interesting that Alexei Navalny, I mean, aroused Zolotov's ire, particularly by highlighting some of the numerous dodgy deals in which he was involved, which particularly tended to mean sweetheart contracts for providing services to the National Guard at inflated prices. And of course, Zolotov refuses to acknowledge any reality behind these charges. Though it's worth noting that for 3 years in a row, for example, he holidayed in the Seychelles as a guest of Boris Vaninsky, owner of the Friendship of Peoples Corporation. What a great title. And it happens to be one of the National Guard's monopoly suppliers. But hey, I'm sure that's just a coincidence and they are just good friends. What's interesting is that, look, Putin elevated Zolotov. Putin created Zolotov. But Zolotov is, I think it's important to stress, a henchman rather than a friend. There's absolutely no evidence that I've found, and again, if anyone out there knows of evidence, then please let me know, that Zolotov, I don't know, holidays with Putin the way Shoigu does, or you know, actually spends quality time with him. It's not even the case. I mean, actually, when he addresses Putin, even in private, he still uses the formal we terms instead of tea as a sort of a friend. So, you know, he's definitely on the staff rather than anything else. So that's Putin's perspective. Generally, as near as I can tell amongst his peers and subordinates, he has a pretty unsavoury reputation as not just a bully, but a not particularly smart bully either. I mean, one retired security officer who'd had personal dealings with him when he was still at the Presidential Security Service described him as a thug. There's no depth, no subtlety. All he understands or is interested in is the fist. And that was told to me back in 2014. Likewise, I mean, former FSO Deputy Director Alexander Lunkim called him, again, an ordinary thug. It's funny how the thug word crops up so often. And I remember talking to some really very angry police officers shortly after the creation of the National Guard, who were very bothered about what this would mean for just law enforcement on the ground. who very sort of bitterly characterised him as Putin's Doberman, now trying to walk on his hind legs, which I thought was terribly unfair, because on the whole, my experience of Dobermans has been that they're actually really quite smart. And even his erstwhile patron Korshakov, who, let's be perfectly honest, is himself no saint, called him a scoundrel and warned that he's very vindictive, just like our president, with whom he is close. Look, part of this is politics, part of this is snobbery. And it's certainly the case that the sort of rather better educated officers, people within the sort of upper echelons of the security apparatus, do tend to look down on their more blue-collar peers, people like Zolotov, and indeed people like Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov, who, you know, they will sometimes mock his way of speaking and that kind of thing. But let's be honest, Korshakov is not exactly some kind of elite liberal aesthete or whatever. No, I mean, I think generally speaking, it's not actually as if the spooks and the other security officials have a problem with Zolotov because of his position, or even necessarily of the fact that he is, shall we say, a rather maximalist person. Again, one former presidential staffer put it that he will do whatever he's told to do, whatever, regardless of law or decency. And it's very striking how many actually believe the story that was then told, an uncorroborated story, I have to say, but anyway, told by the defector Sergei Tretyakov, that Zolotov, along with the former head of the FSO, Yevgeny Murov, actually once kind of considered amongst themselves how to assassinate not just the former presidential chief of staff, Alexander Voloshin, but a whole bunch of other people who they thought was necessary to properly clear Putin's path to power. Until Zolotov bitterly complained that it's too many to kill, even for us. Ah, the poor dear. So, look, generally speaking, there's a consensus that Zolotov is not smart, that Zolotov is absolutely a creature of Putin's, that Zolotov will do whatever he is told to do, regardless of whether it's right, wise, or legal. And, look, he's, even his own people, frankly, often find him a bit embarrassing. I mean, not to question Zolotov's toughness or whatever, but you know, when do you remember that hat? You know, his huge saucer hat that he was wearing in the video in which he responded to Navalny's video. And, I mean, who on earth counseled him that that was a good idea? God only knows. But anyway, he responded back in 2018 to Navalny's, frankly, very plausible allegations of embezzlement with this much-derided video of his own, challenging him to a duel and threatening to make mincemeat out of him and such like. Notwithstanding the fact that both the Federal Security Service and the Prosecutor's Office were investigating those very cases at the same time, those very cases that Navalny was highlighting. But the interesting thing is the degree to which, for example, his own people found that deeply embarrassing. Zolotov making this kind of mumbling appeal to the honour of an officer and such like, and then basically threatening to give Navalny a damn good kicking. Put it all together, and what this means is it's clear that Zolotov has strikingly few allies within the Russian leadership. And in some ways, I would suggest that that's exactly part of the reason why it was he who Putin elevated and relied on. Because precisely, this, you know, he's no team. He has no power base. Putin doesn't need to fear him. He has to obviously cooperate with the other security chiefs. But that's often not easy. And it's quite striking the degree to which he has either made enemies or at least very much failed to make friends or allies. I mean, let's just go through them. Sergei Shoigu, defense minister, definitely wary of Zolotov. He certainly blames Rosgvardia for the sort of dramatic Ukrainian advances out of Kharkiv in September 2022, where it was the Rosgvardia who are holding a lot of the positions. I mean, I think that might be slightly unfair. The Rosgvardia is not really equipped or trained for straightforward modern warfare, but still, there you go. Nonetheless, even though there are strong and, I think, again, quite plausible rumours that Zolotov, Rosneft head Igor Sechin, and Sergei Chemizov, the chief executive officer of the arms firm Rostec, have actually been trying to blame Shoigu for a lack of progress in the war, even then, Shoigu hasn't actually sort of publicly clashed with Zolotov. But again, it was quite interesting that there was a view of a Moscow insider who, you know, with pretty good ministry connections, who said that, like Prigozhin, Zolotov may only notice the knife after it's deep in his back. And I thought, A, that was a very good encapsulation of how Shoigu operates, but also precisely of the sort of that Zolotov may well not know what hit him until it's hit him. There's a lot of cooperation, obviously, between Rosgvardia and the Federal Security Service, the FSB, not least because Rosgvardia does not still have any kind of investigatory function. So in some ways, Rosgvardia has the door kickers. The FSB will often be the one who tells them which doors to kick down. That's not something that Zolotov likes, though. He has time and again tried to build up an investigatory capacity within Rosgvardia. And it's been Alexander Bortnikov, the head of the FSB, who time and time again has stopped this. Bortnikov clearly has minimal contact with Zolotov and has repeatedly and successfully appealed over his head to Putin or to Nikolai Patrushev, Secretary of the Security Council, whenever Zolotov tries to park his tanks on the FSB's lawn. And what's interesting is the degree to which a lot of the primary scandals which have affected Rosgvardia, including the embezzlement ones that Navalny highlighted, actually it's the FSB that ends up revealing them, investigating them, and so forth. So look, I mean, I think it is fairly clear that actually the FSB is very keen to keep Zolotov in his place, to keep the Rosgvardia in their place, and not allow them to expand their remit at all into its territories. Bit late for Interior Minister Kolokoltsev, who, like many within his ministry, still feels very bitter about the way that sort of Zolotov stole forces from him to form his new service. Because there is this sense that, look, Zolotov must have been in communication with Putin beforehand. It's not like Putin just suddenly decided out of nowhere to create the National Guard and appoint Zolotov. But definitely, it was certainly bounced on Kolokoltsev. And this bitterness has actually only just simply been rekindled of late by what's happened with the Grom Special Forces Unit within the Interior Ministry. I'm sorry, I'm going to be going into a bit of Special Forces wonkery for a moment. But the point is that when the National Guard was created, one of the big problems was precisely that the Amon Riot Police, but above all the Sobor Rapid Response Teams, who had been part of the police force, were now part of the National Guard. Now, what this meant was that if the cops suddenly found themselves in a dangerous position, and they needed the kind of, you know, higher level armed support, whereas once upon a time they would have just simply contacted the local Sobor team and got them pulled out. Now what happens is it has to go up the chain of command. A more senior police commander has to contact his oppo, his representative, his counterpart rather, in the National Guard, ask for the deployment of a Sobor team. There will be kind of cross finances, transfers, because basically the MVD will have to pay the National Guard for this. It takes longer for the Sobor to be deployed. It's just more complex, the sort of handling of any of these situations, which incidentally, I have a suspicion may well have played a part in the terrible Crocus terrorist incident, in that it was, you know, when the terrorist incident first of all happened, it was reported to the police. This was clearly something that actually needed a heavy armed response. And therefore, there was time wasted, frankly, by the police then having to report this to the National Guard then deciding to operate. Anyway, so you know, there's a lot of these problems which actually have a real impact if you're a cop on the ground who may suddenly find yourself in a position where you're in a firefight and you need backup. So one of the few forces that had been left within the Interior Ministry was Grom, Thunder, the special forces unit that actually had in turn joined the Interior Ministry when it absorbed the anti-drug service. And so what Kolokoltsev has been doing in recent years is expanding Grom quite dramatically and using it in some ways in the place of Sobor, so that the cops still had their own dedicated special forces when they needed it. This then did not sit comfortably with Zolotov, and Zolotov convinced Putin that Grom also needed to be transferred to the National Guard. Look, he did not need additional special forces. This was just simply a way of trying to keep the Interior Ministry from having a surrogate for Sobor. So, you know, no wonder Kolokoltsev is peeved, let's say, again. Who might say is regarded sometimes as an ally? Well, obviously there's Ramzan Kadyrov, but even then, this is, I think, a pragmatic and transactional relationship. Sure, they talk up each other. Kadyrov called Zolotov, you know, a true patriot, a true comrade in arms, and given him medals and vice versa. But while they are both united by a pretty sort of maximalist perspective, their authoritarian views, their resentment at the way everyone else looks down on them, they're also rivals for Putin's favour. I mean, if one looks at the Rosgvardia forces of the Chechen Republic, look, these are notionally subordinated to Zolotov. In practice, though, these are Kadyrovtsi. These are Kadyrov's men. They swear a personal oath to him. It is pretty clear that they are, frankly, not in any way part of the National Guard. So, yes, of course, Zolotov and Kadyrov will rely on each other when they need to, but I don't think there's much trust there. Who else? Well, we could also mention Alexei Dumin, former deputy head of the FSO, who now governor of Tula region. Now, Dumin certainly has recognised the degree to which, you know, Zolotov elevated him originally. He owed his early career in the FSO to him. He sort of gratefully described him as a man who did a lot for me in my life, taught me wisdom, because that's where I go for wisdom, Viktor Zolotov. However, Dumin is actually demonstrating himself, I've talked about him in the past, in a previous podcast, actually moving on from being a bodyguard and a bullet catcher. He's actually proving himself to be really quite a complex and effective politician. And he certainly is very much his own man. I mean, remember, this is a man, Dumin is someone who is sometimes described as a potential prime minister, or even more than prime minister. I mean, sometimes people are even thinking of him as someone whom Putin himself might be able to trust enough to treat as his heir apparent. That hasn't really happened. But what one can say is that Dumin and Zolotov have both been presented, by their own partisans at least, as potential future ministers of defence. And I do think that Dumin now regards Zolotov as both an embarrassment with the new constituencies which he's wooing, which is much more the technocrat constituencies. I mean, it's a very close relationship between Tula region and Moscow City, for example. But also, actually, that Zolotov is not just an embarrassment, but also a competitor, shall we say. And an observer who works in the Tula administration said that their kind of recent connections, their recent interactions have been, quote, cordial rather than effusive. Fair enough. So this is basically someone who doesn't seem to have anyone. Oh, poor little Zolotov. I mean, the closest he got to actually building himself a kind of a power base of his own outside the National Guard was in an ultimately unsuccessful attempt to try and dominate the Ministry of Emergency Situations through his relationship with Yevgeny Zinichev. Now, Zinichev had been an officer in the FSO before very, very briefly serving as governor of Kaliningrad, then deputy FSB director, and then head of the Ministry of Emergency Situations in 2018. Now, at the time, this was a big deal, because Shoigu had long led the ministry and, frankly, had very heavily sort of seeded it with his own clients. And he was apparently pretty furious when not just that Zinichev got the job, but that Zinichev began purging so many of his own clients. But on the other hand, Zinichev died in 2021, and this made it all pretty much moot. And although his eventual successor, Alexander Kurenkov, had also served under Zolotov at the FSO and then was deputy director of the National Guard, frankly, he has proven himself not to be willing to basically be Zolotov's kind of client or proxy. So even that got lost out. So what can actually one say from all this kind of rambling discussion of this deeply unpleasant man? Well, look, Zolotov's position is built on two simple and connected factors: his continued value to Putin and his capacity to control the National Guard. And, of course, his value to Putin is, of course, his capacity to control the National Guard. Because this is it. Putin is loyal to his long-serving henchmen, but only up to a point. You know, he would look after Zolotov if he had to sack him, but if he had to sack him, he would sack him. There's no question. Zolotov, I mean, he's 70 years old now. But nonetheless, he doesn't seem to be looking to retire. And in any case, Putin, as I've talked about in the past, seems to be very unwilling to actually have any kind of churn of his security leadership in these current situations. So he basically is holding on to people. Until recently, Zolotov hasn't really had much of a public profile. He certainly hasn't been involved in the kind of ritual repetition of Kremlin talking points. In fact, I mean, until 2017, he hardly appeared in the public spotlight at all. And more recently, I mean, I think in part this is actually his own self-consciousness about his public presentation and his rhetoric. But he basically, you know, avoided doing the public stuff. In fact, he turned to a parliamentarian, Alexander Hinstein, a very hawkish one, who was his special advisor on legal and ideological issues between 2016 and I think it was 2018, as basically his kind of public mouthpiece. But in recent years, Zolotov has actually faced some challenges managing the senior ranks of the National Guard. And the key thing about this was the departure in March 22 of Deputy Director Lieutenant General Roman Gavrilov. Now, unless you are a really deep security wonk, you will have not heard of Gavrilov. And that's entirely normal. He was another FSO veteran brought in by Zolotov. But he was not only Zolotov's, I would say, closest deputy and even potential successor, he was also basically Zolotov's instrument of control within the National Guard. Because part of his duties was control of its main director of internal security, which meant that essentially anyone who Zolotov thought was a threat to him ended up being dismissed or brought under sort of charges or whatever. So much so that Gavrilov became known as Zolotov's cleaner. Four generals and three colonels, for example, were charged with fraud in 2021 alone, to a large extent, it seems, because of Gavrilov's work. So Gavrilov was basically Zolotov's enforcer. Then rumours started to spread that he was under investigation by the FSB. I mean, Hinstein jumped up to furiously reject them, and all of a sudden he was dismissed without any real clear explanation by Zolotov personally during a meeting of senior officers, which is a pretty brutal way of doing things. Thing is, Gavrilov actually did not just have links to Zolotov and was frankly one of the more able National Guard commanders. He also had personal ties to both Medvedev, well, that probably wasn't that important, but also Putin. And it's unclear, quite frankly, whether Gavrilov was deeply corrupt, stepped on too many toes, or whatever. But anyway, Zolotov has now had to fire the person who actually was most important to his own control over his own agency. And since then, we've seen Zolotov having to be much more public, admitting that things weren't going quite so well in Ukraine at a time when that was frankly pretty much taboo, talking the kind of talking points that up to now he hasn't really been doing so, and finding increasingly strong, I would say, suggestions that his control over the National Guard was under question. Now, in particular, obviously, we saw this during the Wagner mutiny, when Rosgvardia forces essentially chose to stand down, even the ones in Rostov-on-Don, when the mercenaries were taking over. And as I've mentioned in the past, Zolotov seems to have spent most of the sort of the fateful Saturday of the mutiny desperately trying to contact local commanders along the route of march to get some kind of response from them. And they largely tried to make sure that they were out of contact so that they couldn't be given orders that they'd either have to obey or defy. Now, we've got a pledge since then that the Rosgvardia, this is Putin's pledge, are going to get artillery and tanks, though that's frankly a pretty empty pledge at the moment, because priority is clearly going to units that are being deployed in Ukraine. But nonetheless, you know, we've got this whole question of how far is Zolotov truly in charge? For the moment, I would say he's safe in his position, despite his age. I mean, this is increasingly becoming a septuagenarian regime. And particularly because none of his potential successors seem to have the same kind of track record of loyalty and thuggish ruthlessness. I mean, what's fascinating is that he brought in a whole bunch of FSO people to head the National Guard. These are precisely the people who have fallen by the wayside, thanks to corruption, embezzlement or incompetence. And increasingly, actually, it's old Interior Minister of Veterans who are dominating the command structure of the National Guard. And the view is that they're on the whole professionally competent, but not political enough. You know, 5 years ago, maybe they'd have been fine to replace Zolotov because the circumstances weren't quite so tense. Now, though, Putin clearly wants people who are absolutely loyal. So, you know, it may well be that he'd bring in another outsider, if there's another outsider he thinks can replace him. But the point is this, is that what's really interesting is that Zolotov, having been able to coast for so long and been able to indulge himself with lateral conflicts with other agencies, now is increasingly having to try and demonstrate that he too is a good boy. He too is both loyal and useful, that he will say the right things, that he can indeed control his own agency. Because if he can't control his own agency, he's just an old man in a silly hat. And I think this is the challenge we see generally across the board with the Russian security leadership. They're getting older. I would suggest that in some cases they're getting a little bit more out of touch. They're presiding over agencies that are feeling increasingly unhappy about the direction of travel. Not necessarily because they have a moral problem with what's happening, but because exactly if you're younger, you have a slightly longer timeline and you're concerned about what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in the country, what's happening in relation to China, all of these big long-term issues. And you're increasingly uncertain if the guys at the top really have what it takes and have, in effect, your interests at heart. So I think Zolotov is in a particularly interesting position. But in some ways, his position is one that is replicated across the rest of the security apparatus. And I'll talk about that in a future podcast. Now, I'm afraid this is what happens when I start talking about the security folk. I do end up rambling on at far too great a length. So thank you very much. And now I will stop. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.